If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming, the pirates are coming, the pirates are coming, you better watch out.
Arr!
It's Space Pirate Radio time. Buckos here on Astronomy.fm Radio. That means it is another Wednesday evening, and this one just happens to be October the 4th, 2017, at just barely past 9 o'clock in the evening for those in the eastern portion of North America. So, Universal Time, that would put it at 1:01 on October the 5th, Thursday morning, 2017, Universal Time. So for the next hour, we're going to be live, and of course, we invite you all to be part of the crew by joining in our chat room at astronomy.fm/chat, or go to the homepage of astronomy.fm and look where it says radio chat. Click on that. Either way, we'll get you to the login page and join us. Love to hear from you. Let us know where you're listening in from. Ask us questions. We'll try to answer them on the air as best we can, or if you have any astronomy question, at least somebody in our chat room will answer it for you, and most likely be true, too. If you're in the chat room, you're part of our crew, so I want to welcome all the crew tonight. We've got you and me, of course, Aquafew, Glenn, Cassie, Evil Spock, Richie, Black Project, Optronics, Doug from Northern Cross Observatory, Plaid Joan, Twist Edge, and Plaid Mac so far. Everyone is welcome to join us in the chat room tonight, of course. All right, got a bunch of stuff to talk about. Where should we just start with the sun as per usual?
Let's start with the sun.
Okay. So we are losing our sunspots. The last big sunspot starting to rotate away, part of active region 2683. And the other one that's just south of it, just barely there. So you still got a couple days of being able to see the sunspots. Of course, then it's time to switch over to hydrogen alpha and see if those spots are associated with much activity that shows up in hydrogen alpha filtering. So, but other than that, looks like behind the sun, it's looking kind of blank. That's not really very encouraging. Maybe a couple of coronal holes are coming around. Nothing too special, though. Looks like solar winds are not very active. Speeds are down at 372 kilometers per second. Particle density at only 3.55 protons per cubic centimeter. So solar winds are kind of like a nice, steady, calm breeze for a space pirate ship, I'd say. Other than that, not too spectacular for.
Well, it was nice to see some sunspots when we were doing some public outreach over the weekend.
Yeah, how did that go?
It went great. So we had our big event, big multi-club event, Astronomy at the Beach at Island Lake State Recreational Area in Michigan. And we had bad weather and really bad traffic on Friday night, because in part because a truck that was 4 inches too tall to go under a particular overpass went under that overpass and knocked it out.
Oh, no.
And it happened to be one freeway exit down from where we were.
Oh, no.
So that was all over the news, freeway closed and everything, you know, bridge being demolished. And actually, the DOT went out there, demolished the bridge quickly, reopened the freeway, but traffic was bad. People had heard about the accident. And so Friday night turnout was not that good. But then Saturday, the weather was spectacular. The turnout was spectacular. We had 3,500 people.
Nice.
So 3,500 people and 40-something telescopes, between 40 and 50 telescopes. That meant for some lines.
Yes. How many clubs participated officially?
Officially, I would say 9.
9 clubs? Excellent.
Yeah, we had a radio club there for the first time ever, so that was cool. At least the first time since I've been involved in the event. Amateur radio group turned up. So it was really fun. So we had a great speaker, Dan Durda from the Southwest Research Institute, did very entertaining talk. Cool guy. I mean, his he gets to blow things up with C4 as part of his job.
Wow, that is nice. Yeah,
making fake impact sites, making explosion craters that are then analyzed to, you know, learn things about impact craters on, say, asteroids.
Not fake impact sites, modeled impact sites.
Well, he does the electronic modeling instead of some live modeling. That involves C4 and a lot of ammonium nitrate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that is an interesting job if you can get it.
Mm-hmm.
And he flies F-18s.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Living a fancy life.
That sounds like a cool place to work.
I think so, too. Sounds fun. Let's see. Did he give a separate talk to just the club members?
No, he gave a really nice talk to the astronomers on Saturday afternoon. That's how we learned about... I don't believe the C4 and the explosions were talked about in the main talk for the kids.
Okay.
Yeah, I was coughing up a storm that Friday night, so I had to duck out of the tent a few times to avoid being a distraction. But it did seem to me I saw both some of the main talk and I saw the astronomer pitch talk, which was really good.
Mm-hmm. New location that worked out well, so that's good.
It did. The beach is gorgeous. And the pavilion is smaller than we're used to, so some people said it was a little claustrophobic in there. But nonetheless, it was a solid roof over our heads when the rain started. And we had a, you know, great concession stand, great rapport with the Rangers. The Rangers had a good time. So all in all, it was a wonderful event. And hopefully that'll put it on a solid footing for many more years of clubs coming together to bring astronomy to the public.
Nice.
Because that is the point of this event, is a star party for the public.
Was the food service provided by the park itself?
It was their Friends of the Park group, okay. Friends of Island Lake, and it was amazing.
Okay.
So it was very meat heavy. So for somebody like me who tends to skew vegetarian, there weren't a lot of options, but we did break down and have some of the pulled pork.
Nice.
Or brisket, I can't remember. But there was mac and cheese and hot dogs and popcorn and... So food was great. Basically, it was a wonderful, wonderful night.
That's good. So we encourage other states, regions, countries to do the same thing. Pull your astronomy clubs together. If you've got a lot of clubs in a close area, try to pull them together and put together one at least once a year major astronomy event like this. Now, sometimes people do it for International Astronomy Day. Sometimes they might pull clubs together. Usually they just go off individually, getting together with a science museum or planetarium or something like that. This is not related with Astronomy Day, totally separate event. The fall weather, so that the weather is moderate, it's cool, decent chance of being mostly cloudless, certainly no snow.
Yes. Well, and it's, again, the many, many star parties exist that are aimed at astronomers.
Mm-hmm.
This one is not for dark sky nights. We prefer to have a crescent moon or any moon.
Or first quarter moon.
First quarter moon, yeah. And we teach people things like stars are colors. As soon as it was dark enough to start showing people stars, I show them Antares and I show them Arcturus, because the idea that stars have colors, that there are these huge, massive stars, many times larger than the sun, one of which is basically guaranteed to go out in a supernova explosion. That's interesting to people. Are you ever going to...
Yes.
Antares specifically, as far as a supernova goes.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to go out to a dark sky site with your astronomy comrades and say, hey, everybody, let's go blow out our eyes looking at Arcturus.
That's right. And the moon.
Right. But that's the point of this event, is to show people... Not just Saturn, which Saturn is great. We're really glad we had Saturn up. But everything. Colored stars, double stars, star clusters, galaxies. Though I've said quite a few times before, Andromeda ain't much to look at. You can get the biggest telescope, and it still is not really going to impress the general public.
Mm-hmm. You have to have something like a Mellencamp, something like that will build images up onto a monitor they can still say it's a live image, so they could see the galaxy that way. But
we actually had one of the clubs did have somebody who had a screen, so that was cool. I did not get to see that in action, but I met him while we were cleaning up,
mm-hmm.
and he told me about his screen and what he had been showing people, and so that is cool.
Did he do projection or just a very large television type of monitor?
I think it was a television monitor, but I didn't see it myself. Like I said, I only got to talk to him after we were taking down everything at the end of the night.
Okay, cool. So good variety of object for people to look at. How about any Uranus or Neptune?
Yes, some people saw Uranus.
Nice.
I believe somebody saw it unaided. I spent most of my night at manning our table.
Mm-hmm.
We have so I did a few. I showed people a few objects right after dusk on Saturday, but then I had to get back to the table and run that, so I didn't get to do a lot of dark sky observing.
So usually each astronomy club has their own table for distributing flyers and stuff like that, and local museums will have somebody there with either a display or just some flyers and stuff like that. And any vendors?
We had an art vendor and we had a Meade telescope repairman.
Okay.
But we had several of the science, Wayne State Planetarium, Michigan Science Center, Cranbrook Institute of Science, University of Michigan Dearborn Planetarium. So several planetarium type science museums.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few clubs had tables. We had the radio group. That was neat. They had their antenna out on the field.
Oh, nice. And did you buy any meteorites this time?
The meteorite man was not there this time.
Oh, no?
So, no. We did get to show people meteorites, which was great because our speaker's talk, you know, had a lot to do with meteorites and near-Earth objects. So actually the president of one of our fellow clubs, the Oakland Astronomy Club, he brought some samples from his meteorite collection, which is amazing. So he had some very nice meteorites to show people.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Let's see. So the question in our chat room, did everybody get to look through a telescope? And I would say probably yes.
Everyone got to look through. Not everybody got to look through every telescope because of some of the lines. So I did have some people come up and say, I didn't get to look through the big one because it looked like the line was an hour. I only got to see Saturn, you know, some things like that. So, but, you know, the cure for that, for the most part, is more volunteers mm-hmm. and more telescopes.
Mm-hmm. Plus, there was a talk going on, too. So
yes.
If you stopped to go listen to a talk, you lost at least an hour of going to look through telescope signs.
Right. Oh, and we had an ISS pass, a very good ISS pass. So that was great, too.
Nice. That was planned, of course. we scheduled it for the event. You know.
Yeah, we had some bizarre object pass overhead Friday night that everybody was anticipating the ISS pass at about 9:11 p.m.
Uh-huh.
And about 90 minutes before that, there was apparently, I had just missed it. I walked out on the field right after it happened. A huge, bright, white, long-lasting object going across the sky. And it was not listed on any of the sites that we were tracking. Like, I think it was not listed on Heavens Above as one to watch. So the only thing that we could think of was, given the timing, was that it was an earlier ISS pass that for some reason was not documented. Because it was about 90 minutes before the one that we were expecting to see.
Mm-hmm.
So that was cool. I missed it, as I said, but that was very impressive to everybody on the field who did get to see it.
Well, if the one pass was fairly high or you know, towards the north or towards the south, and another one would be more towards, might be central. So, there should have been one scheduled an hour and a half before or after that.
We were expecting the one at 9:11, and then we were expecting a later one, say 11:45, that was supposed to be low across the horizon.
Okay. And so this one was before the...
Yeah, it was about 7:45.
And it was fairly high up then, huh?
Yes, to my understanding.
Definitely a different one or something.
Yeah.
Did it have like three masts with square sails on it?
Oh, you were doing a flyover, so that's why you weren't there with the telescope.
That's correct. We'll take credit for that one. How about that? Let me go down the list. What's happening with the moon and planets coming up this week? Let's see. Tomorrow, Venus and Mars. You got to look for this tomorrow morning, everybody. They're going to be within a quarter of a degree of each other tomorrow morning before the sun rises. And then, of course, as I always say, if you can look at them in the daytime, this is a really great time to see Mars in the daytime. Tomorrow, pretty much throughout the whole early part of the daytime, not late in the evening, but throughout most of the daytime, if you can spot Venus, and then it will make it, being that close to Mars, it'll make it a lot easier to actually find the planet Mars. So give it a shot, see if you can find them. If you can get to them, you know, early in the morning before the sun rises, that's a little bit better, because obviously you'll see Venus, and then you might need a pair of binoculars to spot Mars. That's pretty close for a small telescope, regular little power, 10, 20 power, something like that. Give that a shot tomorrow morning, and then those of you that have tried it before, see if you can actually see Venus and Mars in the daytime sky. Also, tomorrow for your observing pleasure is the full moon. Yeah, great way to wipe out deep sky
everything.
Objects. Yeah, everything. Deep sky
everything.
Objects. Everything except planets and double stars. So, still some, but you never know. Some of you might have a chance of seeing a satellite or the International Space Station flying in front of the moon. Go to CalSky, CalSky, and see if, type in your coordinates and see if something's going to fly in front of the moon tomorrow. You just never know. Somewhere in the world, you'll probably be or possibly be lucky enough to actually have a pass in front of the full moon. So check that out. Might not be the International Space Station, might be some other satellite, but definitely is possible. So check that out. On Friday, Uranus will be 4 degrees north of the moon. Sunday, Mercury and Superior conjunction, which is not even worth mentioning because that means it's on the far side of the sun. So, yeah, no big deal. Monday, moon's at perigee, which means it is at its closest to the Earth. Also Monday, Aldebaran will be 0.6 degrees south of the moon, and somewhere in the world there will be an occultation, moon covering up Aldebaran. And that's the general observing for this week until next week. Yeah. That's from, by the way, U.S. Naval Observatory. So the address, I'll just, in case you're just listening in, not getting our links in the chat room, is asa.usno.navy.mil. So you can type that in, and you can, it's right on the front page. It's actually the Astronomical Almanac Online. So you type either of those, take that name in, Astronomical Almanac Online, in your search engine, or type in that web address, and you'll get it right on the front page. And of course, that's where a lot of other information is on planets and their satellites and things like that, too. So check that out. And I always keep that in one of my favorite lists, too. Let's see what's happening. Is space rock going to fly by?
Yeah.
Making a little bit of news. Let's see. Actually, one flew by 2 days ago. Nobody mentioned that. It wasn't not real big. It was only about 25 feet in diameter, but it passed at a distance of about 50,000 miles. The next one's going to be a little bit bigger, somewhere between 45, 50 feet in diameter, something like that, but it's going to pass at a distance of about 25,000 miles. So somewhere near the geosynchronous satellites is going to be a space rock. This cool. One designated 2012 TC4. I didn't get a chance to look this one up, see if it's going to pass in the nighttime side, and see if it's going to pass where it will be in some sunlight. If it is, that would be a great one to see. Certainly something 50 feet in diameter at the distance of geosynchronous satellites will be visible through a small telescope, if all the conditions are just right about that one. So maybe some of you will actually be able to get a chance to see this one. So check that out. Now that's at the list at the bottom of the page of spaceweather.com. So they're called near-Earth asteroids. There's a chart all the way down. And ones that are highlighted in a pinkish red, those are the ones that are the closest. So if you want a quick glance, you can get an idea what's going to be the closest. It lists a lot of rocks. Some of the rocks are, you know, several miles in diameter, but they're also several millions of miles from us. I mean, sometimes Venus will be closer to us than some of these rocks, but they still list them anyway. Sometimes they're close, sometimes they're medium, sometimes they're big, sometimes they're small. It's nice when you combine everything together with a big rock fairly close and the right conditions to actually be able to see it. It's fun watching them. They move quickly, though, so you have to have a pretty good star chart of its position, and it can move several degrees per hour, so you have to get a pretty good idea of where it's going to be and be able to get your scope in the right position in order to be able to see these. It can be a little bit tough to see. Another observing challenge. It makes it a little bit more fun if you're used to seeing everything out there. What's this, a Sputnik anniversary, I think?
Yeah, 60 years.
Since Sputnik?
60 years of the space age.
Since it first launched and flew around the Earth?
Yep. So, yeah, we've got some nice little retrospectives on Sputnik.
What does Sputnik mean?
Oh, I thought it just meant moon.
I don't know.
I used to know this.
I did too, but I don't remember it all.
Come on, friends in the chat room.
Yeah, give us, look it up quick, Google it, whatever. What does the word Sputnik mean? Of course, it had a lot of spinoffs for that era, like Beatnik.
Pupnik, a.k.a. Laika from Sputnik 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's see, that was like
1957.
57. I was 1 year old then, or ish. Black Project.
My father wasn't born yet.
Well,
yeah.
You are a youngie.
Yes.
I got it from Black Project. Sputnik means
traveling companion. Yeah, yes, fellow indeed. Traveler.
Fellow traveler. Nice. All right. Let's see. Where do we want to go? All right. Let's check what's launching at NASA. Well, not launching at NASA, but what NASA has is coming up some spacewalks.
Oh, that's cool.
All this week. Yeah, a bunch of them. Let's see. October the 5th. Let's see. There's a first in a series of three planned spacewalks. So tomorrow, starting at 6:30 in the morning, Eastern Daylight Time. So you can go to the NASA homepage and go to NASA television. You can actually watch them do that. They're just doing some general repairs on the outside of the space station. Now, that would be just kind of an interesting little bit of trivia, that when the space station is actually flying over your area while there are astronauts on the outside of the space station. Also, next one's going to be on, after that, October the 10th. And also October the 18th. So, three spacewalks coming up. And again, check the NASA website, NASA television. You can actually see that, usually live images of what they're doing. It's fun too.
So we've got a little update from a dead mission.
A gag mission?
Dead mission.
Spell that.
D-E-A-D, dead. It's not, it's over. It stopped. It crashed.
Okay.
But we got another picture.
Okay.
So we've got the final, really, truly, previously unseen image of Rosetta before it crashed. It's not the prettiest picture that Rosetta took in the mission by any means, but it's cool because it is the last.
Mm-hmm. It's an official last one.
Well, sort of. The picture that I'm about to share with you is the penultimate image. The final image is partially reconstructed.
Okay. Rosetta is a space probe that went to the comet Churyumov-Gerasimenkov.
67P, yeah.
Yep.
So this article has both of them, both the what we thought was the final image, which it's blurry rocks. I mean, it is not a pretty picture, but it was 25 meters up, so that's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
The real final picture was about 5 meters lower, so just before crashing, it is a 1x1 square meter of the comet, and they reconstituted it using some telemetry data.
Okay. Kind of like some of those early probes to the surface of the moon.
Yes.
Where they're imaging it as it's heading down, down, down. And the last one, yeah, you can kind of tell there's a surface there, but it's gotten pretty blurry. Comes up fast.
And I always like snack.
That. Yep. I always like that mission. Create an unusual cometary body with two lobes.
The rubber ducky comet, yeah.
Mm-hmm, floating in space. It really gives you that, when you look at the pictures of it, it really gives you that idea that there's no up or down. There's nothing around it. It's just blackness and sunlight on this thing. I also think about, which way is gravity on this thing?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, if you're on the side of the big lobe, the gravity is towards the middle of it. Your side of the little lobe, your gravity is towards the middle of it. But if you're in between the two, is gravity sideways? It's down sideways? I mean, could you be on the bottom of something and looking up and fall up in some areas of this thing? Can you stand on, between the two, we'll stand on the little lobe and actually be lifted off the surface by the gravity of the big lobe? I always thought that was kind of an interesting perspective.
Well, it's neat you should point that out, because our speaker for the event last weekend, Dr. Dan Durda, so he was talking about prospective missions to asteroids. And so he pointed out that the likely mission of humans first visiting an asteroid will not be to a big main belt asteroid. It won't be to Vesta, much less Ceres. It'll be to one of the tiny little asteroids near to Earth that probably won't be that much larger than the ISS itself. Mm-hmm. So imagine visiting one of these bodies. Imagine what the microgravity would be on an ISS-sized little rubble pile floating through space.
It would pretty much have no gravity.
Yeah.
Kind of like being outside the ISS itself. If you're not tethered, or if you don't have if they still have manned maneuvering units, on your back with jet set, it'll actually push you around. You would not be able to hold on to it. You would not be able to stand on it, for instance. Any little shake would pop you right off of it.
Yeah. So imagine doing, getting a sample, mm-hmm. doing science on something with that kind of gravity.
Mm-hmm. You could try to, shoot a projectile anchor with a cord on it into it, but I think you would probably have to do that while flying towards it. You fly towards it, you shoot the spike into it, and that should be calculated to actually stop your forward motion, and kind of like a fishing spear, and it would hopefully puncture to a deep enough depth where you could pull the cord and pull yourself towards it and still have enough depth and hold on it, where it actually you could fasten into it and hold down on it. You would not be really standing on that. That would probably be almost impossible to stand on it. Maybe as a gimmick, put that spike mm-hmm. kind of between your feet and pull down on the cord and kind of hold yourself to it. But most be something that big, it would be like floating up next to a wall. Like neutral buoyant in a swimming pool and floating up, going up to the wall in a swimming pool, with neutral buoyant weights on you. So you're like not drifting up the surface, not sinking down to the bottom, but you're facing right at the wall. And again, if you wanted to do anything on that asteroid, you'd have to do it against the pull of that cord. And if you tried to swing a hammer into it, you'd make contact and it would fling you back away from it. So that's what that would be like. Real microgravity too.
Yeah. No, it would be fascinating. It would be a totally different kind of mission than what we think of when we, look at the old footage of the astronauts on the moon mm-hmm. collecting rocks.
Mm-hmm. Definitely be a different type of challenge. Or could they fly, the craft close enough to it themselves and, step out?
I would expect I believe he said they'd rendezvous and, float down.
Yeah, I wonder what distance. Float down. It's like, again, I don't think there would be enough gravity to actually float down to it.
Well, right. You need a tether, or, as you said, one of those MMU packs, like from the early days of the space shuttle.
Yep. But, so I wonder what And then you'd have to, of course, hopefully you get lucky enough to get a good hold with the spike, too. If you hit some kind of rock, it basically would just bounce off. And that could be dangerous. Shoot a spike into it, and it'd have it bounce back at you, or bounce back at your spacecraft, and poke a hole in it. That would not be good. A couple ways of doing it. Maybe send some sort of a drone to it with a spike on it. That would have to be a sort of a jet-propelled drone. Could not have propellers.
Right. No, so like no
some,
wind.
Yep, no wind. So maneuvering jets, going to it, and then fire jets and fire the projectile and right into it. Hopefully it captures and be out of the way in case it bounces away. Be interesting to see what they actually come up with to be able to do that. A lot of possibilities.
And we just hit the bottom of the hour.
We did. Go for it.
And you are listening to Space Pirate Radio on astronomy.fm.
Now, the way we would get to it would be swing from one of the yard arms by a rope.
We just take the whole thing, Marty.
Yeah, we could do it. Yep.
Yeah. A little space rock the size of the ISS. Yep. Just pick it up and take it home.
There you go. Put it in the hold. No problem. Ballast. Want to say hi to everybody in our chat room again. I've got you and me, of course. Aquafew, Glenn, Cassie, Evil Spock, Richie, Black Project, Optronics, Doug, Plaid Joan, Twist Edge, Plaid Mac, Sister, Plaid Sister. Basically, a crowd from all around the world are visiting us while we're on air, and we consider you part of our crew tonight. So come on over to our chat room. You'll find it at the homepage, astronomy.fm, or just type in astronomy.fm/chat, and you'll get to the chat room, too. At least you get to the login, then you'll get to the chat room.
You can also interface with us on our Facebook page.
There you go. Space Pirate Radio. And then a dash astronomy.fm. You'll find us. And please come on over and like us there. We always put stuff, we put links. If we're going to talk about a specific article, then we'll put links in our Facebook page. So if you're listening to us in an off time from the live time, you can look at those links and click on them and see the articles that we're talking about and get more detail if you want to read them later also. What was I going to say also about something? I'm always going to say something about something, aren't I? Oh, yes. Don't forget, we will repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours with, of course, more programming in between. We'll also have Astronomy Ireland. Should have the usual lineup of planetary radio from the Planetary Society, Naked Astronomers, Naked Scientists, all coming up after Space Pirate Radio. So keep tuned in. And of course, I always got to say hi to the guys that follow us at Astronomy Ireland.
Yes.
Well, let's see.
We got some news stories.
Go ahead. What you got?
All righty. If I can clear my throat. Okay. So, Nobel Prize.
Ah, yes, indeed.
So the Nobel Prizes are being handed out, and three American physicists have won the 2017 Nobel Prize in Physics for their contribution to detecting gravitational waves. So the three are Rainier Weiss from MIT, Barry Barish from Caltech, and Kip Thorne from Caltech, who is probably the most famous of this trio because of his involvement with things like the movie Interstellar.
Mm-hmm.
He actually came to town a few weeks ago, and my husband got to meet him.
Nice.
So my husband has now officially met a Nobel Prize winner.
How come I didn't hear about this?
You probably weren't at the club meeting that night.
Oh, must have been the other
club. Yeah, he did two talks, at one at U of M Ann Arbor, and then one at Wayne State University.
Okay.
And my husband was able to attend the Wayne State one, and he's got a picture of himself hanging out with Kip Thorne.
Nice.
Who is now a Nobel laureate.
Nice, real nice. Kind of a related story. I've got one here, since we're kind of on merging black holes.
Yes.
Let me put this story in our chat room here. It is a discovery of other potential merging black holes. They're basically pairs. I think they found five new pairs. Potentially future merging supermassive black holes. Most of the merging black holes before are been around multi-stellar mass, 35, 20 solar mass black holes that have combined together to become like a, basically a 50 sun mass black hole. Basically, if you took 50 suns and crashed them all together, that would make a black hole that size. Supermassive ones are ones that are in the centers of galaxies, and they can contain millions of solar masses. And the way you get a couple of solar masses inside of, supermassive black holes inside of one galaxy is by merging two galaxies together. Now, the galaxies never, you know, crash directly together. They get close, and the supermassive black holes in the center of them will end up orbiting around each other. And depending on the dynamics of the system, they can eventually merge together as they orbit around, getting a little bit of drag because there will be lots of gas and stars that will slow them down. They'll get spiraling in closer and eventually merge big black holes into even bigger black holes. The gravity wave detectors cannot see these galaxies getting closer. They probably can see them as they merge, but not see them actually getting closer. They're still a little bit too far away. What it takes is higher resolution detectors looking in the centers of galaxies to be able to pick out, for instance, two X-ray sources like the Chandra X-ray Observatory. Can be able to have enough resolution to see two basically X-ray hotspots in the center of a galaxy and be able to watch them and see them moving. So far, they've got and basically they would check galaxies that it looked like they're, you know, visibly crashed together. You can really pretty easily tell that a couple of galaxies have recently merged because of their odd shapes or twists and turns, and you might even see a couple of cores, or they're kind of look like maybe one core with, you know, spiral arms in multi different directions instead of evenly flat. So they're able to actually look for galaxies that look like they're colliding and then look into those galaxies with higher resolution telescopes, and they're actually able to pick out so far five pairs of black holes that look like they will be merging sometime in the future. Let's talk the near future, like a billion years from now.
Yeah, mark your calendars.
Exactly.
So speaking of, we've got some breaking news actually relayed to us by our engineer.
Break it.
Yeah, so you talk about space rocks. 2 to 4 meter super bolide has just fallen over southern China.
Oh, nice.
It's traveling 14.6 kilometers a second, fell over the northern parts of Yunnan province near the northern border of Myanmar. It estimated radiant energy of 192 gigajoules, making it a very energetic impact, the most energetic in more than a year. Mind you, it didn't hit, but it looks like it blew up in the Earth's atmosphere.
Okay.
So, cool. And mm-hmm. Our source for this is, we've got, there's a video on Chinese social media on Weibo.com, so we can share that with you guys.
Okay, sounds
and
cool.
And we've got a little write-up in a Lunar Meteorite Hunter's Blogspot blog. So.
And did they say, when was this? Oh, they occurred at about 8 p.m. their local time.
Yes.
So they're pretty much on the opposite side of the world, so probably about 12 hours ago.
So 7 hours prior to 12 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, which would have been 3 p.m. our time, so it would have been 7 hours prior to 3 p.m.
Okay. And the video would be pretty cool to see if they got it all on video. That'd be nice. Let's see, 4 to 8 meters, about 25 feet at the biggest. I think they just estimated it by size of the explosion, I would assume.
I think so, yeah.
A little bit of variabilities on the density of the material, so a little denser material would probably, I would assume, have a little bit more of a boom to it.
Yeah.
Or a lighter material, if it was bigger and made out of lighter material, that would be comparable type of boom to it also.
Yeah, if it's a total rubble pile asteroid or meteorite.
need to write comet body, cometary body, depending on what it's made
space
out of.
Space vermin.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see if some meteorites become available out of this or not. Something else to go for.
Yeah, Optronix asked in the chat room, and how many broken windows this time, which this article does not say. So mm-hmm. interesting, but I'm sure there will be more to come.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely as more information is released, we'll get it to you next week.
So we've got a couple other stories. Just in passing, we've covered some of the ups and downs of the proposed 30-meter telescope that's was intended to be built on top of Mauna Kea on the Big Island of Hawaii in the U.S. And it's been green-lighted again after several years of delays. Now, if the telescope does not get started by the deadline of April of 2018, the TMT will relocate to La Palma in the Canary Islands. So we shall see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm. Got an article, sort of new data from an old probe, Mars, NASA's Mars Orbiter.
Okay.
They've basically kind of reprocessed some data and found some indications of hydrogen in one of the equatorial regions of Mars. And that potentially means that there water? May be a source of it, yes, which would be water, mm-hmm. unexpectedly near the equator. Now, this actually could affect future manned missions instead of having to go near the polar regions or for looking for water, that they might actually be able to pick some up into an equatorial region, which could benefit, for instance, as far as like, you know, launching back off the planet. Let me put this article into our chat room here. Read this a little bit further. So basically, kind of like image processing, you know, you take some old photographs and then, you know, reprocess it with some better computers and increase the resolution, combine data and stuff like that. That's kind of what they did with this data. And we're able to detect some hydrogen around the equatorial region of Mars. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, well, we've got another little Mars story. Kind of a scary one, actually.
I like Mars.
JPL.
I like Mars stories. Go.
So an unexpectedly strong blast from the sun hit Mars this month. It was observed by some NASA missions, both in orbit and on the surface. So it's a solar event on September 11th of 2017, and it sparked a global aurora on Mars, more than 25 times brighter than any previously tracked by the MAVEN orbiter, which has been up there since 2014. It produced radiation levels on the surface more than double any measured by the RAD, the Curiosity rover's radiation detector that's been up there since 2012. And these high readings lasted for more than 2 days. So, Marty, what does that mean?
Zapper.
That means that if we had people on Mars, That would be very bad.
That would be very bad if they're out on the surface.
If they're out on the surface, yeah.
Without any protection from radiation. Or even traveling to the planet Mars.
You'd be a sitting duck.
Depending. Now, getting to Mars is not like a direct route going like from the sun to the Earth to Mars at opposition, you know, straight out. Now, the particles from the sun would basically do that with a little bit of spiral. But astronauts heading towards the planet Mars might actually be on the opposite side of the sun during that as they start to get into a larger orbit and basically catching up to the planet Mars, or have Mars catch up to them as they get into that orbital distance too. So it could go either way if astronauts were on the route to the planet Mars. And Mars got zapped. But also, the opposite could happen, too, where if the astronauts were en route to the planet Mars and the sun let off a blast that went the opposite side of the sun from the Earth, that might be right at those astronauts also. A lot of potential for getting zapped without protection on the way to the planet Mars or once you've already gotten there, too.
Or back from, as Uptronix in the chat room just pointed out.
Back from Mars, that's true, yes. So definitely have to overcome that radiation issue on long distance space travel. Well, even to the moon, actually. It's right now they're just kind of playing the odds, flying to the moon for 3 days and not getting zapped. But actually, for an extended mission, much higher risk of that, and have to solve those issues. Kind of like a lot of the old sailing issues when ships went sailing around the world for the first time. The issues they had were more like scurvy, bad diet.
Yes, no matter what they brought. Scurvy is huge. Yes.
So they had a lot of issues with that. It was able then until they were able to actually solve that technology of what was making them sick and on extended ocean voyages and what would prevent them from being sick.
Right, because it was a very long process filled with a lot of trial and error and unfortunately many deaths to determine what would prevent scurvy.
Mm-hmm.
And so Glenn in the chat room said, take lemons. I'm like, yes. Even once they zeroed in on lemons, but they were doing things like cooking the lemons and preserving it in syrup, which doesn't help much.
They thought it was more associated with land originally, so basically they just made sure they landed, and they would even, like, I don't know, sort of bury people in the sand up to their necks because they were, like, you know, attached to the land more that way, and that they thought that would make them healthier.
Well, and one of the theories was simply that it was an issue of cleanliness. So, you know, you keep a clean ship, you don't get scurvy. It's like, well, you've got a clean ship and you've got lousy rations, you're still going to get scurvy.
Yes.
So, yeah, it was definitely a fascinating and really kind of disgusting process of determining what it, you know, how you would do it. And even so, even when, say, the mid-19th century, when, say, the British Royal Navy understood enough that they were keeping people properly provisioned, you still had horror shows like the Franklin Expedition in what's now Nunavut, Canada, where they were on a 3-year expedition and everyone died.
Mm-hmm. Or a lot of times, most of them died. It was just expected to lose a major percentage of your crew on a long ocean voyage. Sometimes it's even your crew leader, too, your captain.
Magellan. Magellan being the big one. Of course, Ferdinand Magellan, he did not circumnavigate the globe because he died.
That's correct.
His mission circumnavigated the globe. But yeah, the casualties in the Magellan expedition were horrible. Those were outliers. Like by the time, again, say the era of polar exploration, which is one of my passions, by the time you've got people making expeditions to the North Pole, the South Pole, in the 19th century, losing a few people would be a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Losing your entire crew, like the Franklin expedition did, was just unheard of. That was like the equivalent of, I don't even know what to relate it to. I mean, you send out, that was the most best prepared, best provisioned, cutting edge technology expedition, and it doesn't come back and they find out everyone's dead.
Yep. Still happens.
Still happens. Well, yes. if we become a spacefaring civilization,
mm-hmm.
humans sailing out to the, we will experience the interstellar equivalent of that.
Yes.
And we will like it about as much as they did, which is, it was a very kind of a traumatic thing for England at the time. And in it's become really a defining moment in Canadian history.
Mm-hmm.
Because Canada didn't even exist as such at that point. Canada, you know, became Canada as we know it in 1867. 150 years ago, but it's very much a big part of the you know, Canadian identity myth, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I'm going to a big exhibition of relics in March in a major Canadian museum in Quebec. Yeah,
nice.
I can't wait.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
But yeah, scurvy, big problem, and it took a long time to figure out what you could possibly do to prevent it.
Yeah, they didn't know where it came from and what caused it even. So they kept trying different things that worked and didn't work. Yeah. And sometimes they were misled on what worked. They thought it was one thing, oh, we got solved, and then found out, nope, that wasn't the issue.
Or you've got a solution like, say, cooking the lemons, boiling them into a sugar syrup that would keep, but you're losing the vitamin C in the process. That is really kind of heartbreaking because they had the pieces there and the implementation was bad.
Mm-hmm.
I think Optronics asks, how did they stop them on 6-month trips from rotting? I think he's meaning the lemons. Preserve them in rum.
Rum is
lime
good.
Juice with rum. Well, again, we're pirates. Where did grog come? Where did grog come from? Yeah.
Yep.
Mixing rum with stuff.
Keeping your water fresh.
Yeah, or boiling them with sugar, which is a bad idea if you're trying to prevent scurvy.
Mm-hmm. Let's see what we've got here. Oh, let's see. Dawn Mission, by the way, celebrates 10 years in space.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of people kind of forgetting it's been orbiting Dawn for quite a long time, that people are actually starting to forget that there's still images coming back from there, some pretty cool stuff. So let me put this link into our chat room here and check out images of Ceres.
Nice.
Let's see.
You're right. With the I think the closing months of Cassini has kind of eclipsed the Dawn Mission in a lot of people's minds. But as you said, it's still up there and Cassini is dead. So let's pay attention to Dawn while we've got it.
Yep. pretty cool images. And of course, you're still making discoveries about it. Still orbiting around there. It does about a 30-day orbit? Is that what I read? I can't remember now. But still going round and round and getting great pictures. Well, they've got 88,000 photos so far.
Tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of discoveries, we've got an update for you on one of the most intriguing objects out there in space. Tabby's star. We've talked about
yes.
it again. Tabby's star, the alien megastructure star or not. And I, as I reported in August, I got to meet Tabby or Tabitha, as her name actually is, at a university in Nebraska when I was out there for the eclipse, which was really cool.
Nice.
So, Tabby's star, officially named KIC 8462852, has been
preliminarily.
Yeah, we think we might know what it is, and it's not aliens.
Well, not
a decaying Dyson sphere or anything like that. It's probably something very mundane, which won't surprise you, Marty.
I know. It's pyramids.
No.
Orbiting not. Pyramids? Not orbiting
no.
pyramids?
No. 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 Dust. Just dust.
Just dust? A band of dust.
Dust cloud. Okay, so why do we think that? We've been puzzling over this object for quite some time. Why are we going to a solution as mundane as it's dust? So, NASA has used the Spitzer and Swift telescopes, as well as a Belgian astrolab called IRIS, and they're looking at infrared and ultraviolet. There is less dimming in the infrared light of Tabby's star than in its ultraviolet light. So an object larger than dust particles, floating pyramids, a Dyson sphere, anything like that, would dim all the wavelengths equally. But whatever it is that's blocking out the light from Tabby's star only affects the long wavelengths of infrared. So since the dimming is dependent on the wavelength, it's probably dust.
And it would be a cloud of dust.
Yes. A cloud of dust that's quite distant from the star itself. They're talking 700-day orbital period. So that is a far-flung cloud of stuff.
And being a, instead of like a big band of dust going around it, more like a big cloud that would have to be in orbit around the star. So it would dim it out just right. So, but we'll see if they confirm that. Obviously, it's still being researched and it needs further investigation. But I thought they ruled out dust in the past, too, because they weren't picking up the infrared from it. They weren't picking up the infrared from the dust itself, is what I remember hearing in the past.
I believe I heard that too, but this is involves a couple of different telescopes, so I'm sure more people will be paying attention, because this is a hotly studied item. That was one of the cool things about getting to hear Tabitha talk. She had data that had been taken the previous day. So this is an object that is studied so intensely that they've got every day new data being collected on it. And now that we've got this hypothesis of this giant cloud of dust, I'm sure people are going to be looking to either confirm or upend it.
Mm-hmm. We're getting closer to the James Webb telescope being completed and launched. And again, what that one is going to do is going to be mostly an infrared type of telescope with really good high resolution. So it'll be able to penetrate pretty far back into celestial time and maybe be able to see the planets, to be able to image the very first galaxies and stars right after the Big Bang. And the way that works is, how does that work? How do you see back then? Well, those galaxies and stuff like that were right after they formed, and because they've receded from where we are because of all the time that's passed, that they've basically redshifted. So even the stars that were basically ultraviolet, purpley stars, that light would shifted back into the red. So the reddest objects they could see would be the farthest, that are actually the farthest out. So light that's not even shifted from like ultraviolet to red, but it's gone all the way into the infrared. So they're trying to find infrared blobs, really small infrared blobs, out past all the other galaxies. And that would indicate those are some of the very first galaxies that we'll be able to detect. Can only do that with a nice big infrared telescope, and that's what the Webb's going to do.
Yep.
All right, couple of minutes. That's all. We got anything else we got to go over?
You mentioned pyramids. You got any pyramid story for me, Marty?
I don't have a pyramid story for you, no. The Spire rocket, sounding rocket, successfully launched from Wallops Island. That was it was a sounding rocket, so not made to go really high up, but was carrying a parachute test platform. It was successfully launched. And the idea of this thing was to have it come down really fast, the platform come down really fast, open up the parachute without actually shredding the parachute to pieces. So that was what the sounding rocket mission was all about. So basically they can land things on, like Mars, without having it shred the parachute on the way down. All right. That's about it for us. Time for us to head on out here. So appreciate everybody that's been in our... go ahead.
Chat room tonight. Yep. Whole crowd. So we've still got Aqua and Cassie, Evil Spot, Glenn, Richie, Optronics, Doug from the NCO, Plaid Joan, Twist Edge, Plaid Mac, and Plaid Sister. Thank you very much, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Don't forget, we'll repeat this program for every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. And, of course, coming up right after Space Pirate Radio is Astronomy Ireland and more programming, too. So stick around, everybody. Keep listening in. Don't forget to go to our Facebook page, Space Pirate Radio, at astronomy.fm on Facebook. Like us. Love us. Send money. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate y'all listening in. Good night, all. And see
clear
you all.
Clear skies, y'all.
See you all next week. Good night.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
FM.